start with a prayer?
Yeah. Oh, prayer or meditation?
You want to do that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. My name's Juanita, and I'm a member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Juanita.
And it's nice to see y'all back from last night. I think we have some new people here this morning, and welcome to you as well. A couple of you came up to me last night, to us last night, and said you really liked the meditation, and would it be possible to start this off this morning with some more meditation? And if you guys are up for it, we will do that. We'll let a couple of you just kind of settle in and relax. And we'll start off with a moment of silence and the serenity prayer. And then we'll go into the quiet. God, grant me the serenity
to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
So I think my wish for you all, if you get nothing else this weekend, and it doesn't matter whether you're new or you've been in some for some time, is that the most important thing for me and what has been of the most value is my relationship with my Creator. And that relationship, my connection with this Creator, is what has kept me here and what has given me peace and has eased my heart and allowed me to show up and be the person, the woman, that God would have me be. So I'm really liking that you all are enjoying the quiet time and the meditation. When Bill and Bob first got sober, Ann Smith, Dr. Smith's wife, was the one who insisted on quiet time in the morning. If Bill and Bob had had their way, they'd have been out the door and out saving drunks. And Ann insisted that they take some quiet time in the morning. She said that's the most important piece. And Dr. Bob, later on in his book, Good Old Timers, he emphasized first things first and first things being God. So I'll ask you to get comfortable. Get quiet. Feel your body. Begin to breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. Begin at the bottom of your feet, on the soles, to feel a light begin. Begins at the soles, goes up to your ankles. Just a quiet, small light that slowly goes up your calf to your knee with a gentle warmth that begins now to go up your thigh. Soft, gentle light, gentle warmth. Feel it in your butt, your abdomen. soft. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe in, breathe out. Breathe from your belly, slowly filling it, letting it out. With each breath you take in, it's God's love that comes into you, filling you. And with each breath goes your worries, your troubles, your concerns. Breathe in. Breathe out. The light slowly spreads, going up your spine, filling your back, into your shoulders, your chest. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in God's love. Breathe in God's peace. Breathe in God's grace. The light goes down your arms to your shoulders. To your elbows. Down your forearms to your wrists. Into your hands and to each finger. Breathe out your troubles. Let them slide out through your fingertips. And what's left is God's peace, God's love, God's light. The light slowly goes up into your neck, up the back of your head, a nice, gentle light, down your forehead, your eyes, your nose, your ears, cheeks, mouth. The light goes down into your chin, filling you completely. With each breath, you are filled more and more with God's peace. The light begins to grow, filling you more until you feel it radiating out from you, reaching out to your neighbor, filling us all. Breathe in, breathe out. God, we feel your presence with us. We ask this morning, as we begin our day, that you direct our thinking. Divorce our minds from thoughts of self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking motives, so that our thinking may be on a much higher plane, free of these wrong motives, so we might use this brain as you intended. Grant us an intuitive thought or decision as we go about planning our day and as we move through it. Show us what our each and every step should be along the way, and give us whatever we need to take care of such problems. Grant us the ability to relax, take it easy, not to struggle. Just wait for the right answers to come. Take away our self-will to the exact degree it is not of service to you and to our fellow man. Grant us the ability to recognize when we are first becoming agitated or doubtful, irritated, bugged, pissed off, or fearful. And in that moment, grant us your power to pause and ask you for right thought or action, and your power to carry it out. Grant us the ability to remind ourselves consistently throughout the day that we're not running the show, but to say to ourselves in a humble manner, "Your will, not mine, be done." Your will, not mine, be done. Keep us from the dangers of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, foolish decisions, jealousy, self-righteousness, procrastination, perfection, criticism, and judgment. Grant us the ability to become more efficient, not burn up energy foolishly, trying to arrange the show to suit ourselves. Discipline us in this practice as we are undisciplined. Show us the way of kindliness, patience, tolerance, and love with everyone we come in contact with as we go about our day. Help us to grow in effectiveness and understanding and love and tolerance. Grant us the ability to carry the vision of your will for us into all of our activities. How may we best serve you? Again, your will, not mine, be done. Show us what we can do for the person who is still sick and suffering, and grant us whatever it is we need to be able to do your work. We feel your presence. We feel your light deep within us. It burns brightly. Keep me open, God, with this light deep within me as I go about this day. Open me up so that I may let your loving presence shine out from within me, and so that I may experience and see your shining presence in others. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts that we are blessed with this day, and blessed with your bounty, and blessed with the presence of each other. With each breath, we begin to feel not only your presence, but the energy that you are going to feed us with today. An energy that will keep us present. An energy that will prepare us to be receptive to your words, to those thoughts that are of you. With each breath, we take in more and more of your energy, more and more of your light. And as we begin to slowly pay attention with each breath to our body begins to respond to the energy, and we become more and more present to be centered, to be with you and each other today. Slowly we pay attention to our bodies more and more, and slowly we come back to be present to this beautiful day. As you're ready, come back and join us, filled with a new energy to be present. Thank you. Morning. You ready? All right. Let's do it. You want to start us off, honey?
My name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of a loving God, I'm sober and I'm alive, and I'm grateful to be in that shape, and grateful to be here with you all. I guess there's some people who weren't here last night. I'll tell you, I've been continuously sober since June the 15th of 1986. I have a home group in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I'm from. We're called an AA group. Meet at Monday night at the Salvation Army in Santa Fe at 7 o'clock, and you're welcome to come join us. I think you'd, if you're here at this deal, you'd probably like our group quite a bit. Those are some of the components to what I consider make me a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the other components is I do service work. Almost always have a service commitment of some sort, and I sponsor people. I think everybody ought to sponsor. That's my personal opinion. If you're not sponsoring, you should. That's what I think. You know, if you're 2 months sober, you've got something to offer somebody, and that's the way this thing started. And I think that's our real service when it gets down to the basics of it is one alcoholic talking to another. We talked about that last night. Not everybody agrees with that, and you don't have to. That's just what I believe. Let's see. I didn't say last night, to tell you a little bit about myself, I'm 58 years old. Been married to this woman, Juanita, for 28 years. I have four children. Yeah, that's pretty good. first wife only lasted 7 years. I have four children and seven grandchildren. And don't look like an old grandpa. I am, but... let's see. What other pertinent information is there that I can give you? I grew up, I was telling you last night, I went to school, grew up, I didn't really grow up, that's not a good description of it, but I got older in this area, Nassau County. I went all the way through school, and back in late 60s, early 70s, I moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico. I've been there ever since. Did some 90% of my drinking I did in the New Mexico area, but I did some real interesting drinking here in New York, Massachusetts, and Vermont. And I think there's people who still remember me from those days. So that's kind of my deal. Juanita and I met in 1977, and was lust at first sight. And we our mutual sicknesses kind of meshed, and we got sicker together, and then I like to think that we've gotten well together, and that's a story that we try to tell. So last night we started off. Do you want to do more on the doctor's opinion, or are we pretty well? Yeah, I think we pretty well hammered the doctor's opinion last night. Basically, the idea, if you read that, what I get from the doctor's opinion is that this is a real physical illness that can be diagnosed, has a physical component to it, which is beyond any mental considerations or psychological considerations. And the doctor goes over and over that. You know, Bill Wilson says in the doctor's opinion that we believe that any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. And my sponsor, Don P., was very adamant about that. And there was a movement that took place, I don't know, 3-4 years ago. It was rolling along pretty well, where we tried to get the doctor's opinion, which had been page one in the very first printing of the big book, restored. We didn't want to change it. People got their hackles up when we even talked about it. We said, no, we're not saying change it. We're saying restore it to its first edition format so that we get the doctor's opinion back to page one and people don't miss it. And in New Mexico, we brought it up at the area level, and we had tremendous debates and fights. And, you know, you have people who got sober anytime after the second edition came out, which was 1955, who were just adamantly against, you know, any messing with the big book whatsoever. They'd never heard of restoring it. They, you know, old timers were railing against it and all this. Finally, it went to a vote in my area, and I think it was 55-18 against doing anything about it. And I was a GSR at the time, and I called Don, and I said, Don, you know, it's just a horrible failure. We just, you know, we got voted down so badly. I said, if anything at all happened, I said, maybe we raised the consciousness about the doctor's opinion a little bit. He said, what'd you think you were doing it for to begin with? He said, what'd you think the point of it was, you know? So anyway, and there's still some of us who are making waves about that. I don't think it'll ever happen. But at any rate, it's extremely important. I think if you don't start there, you don't understand that it is an illness. You know, I always say in my home group, if I don't have a physical disease, I'm just a nut job, you know. I'm just a wacko, you know, who is doing something that's destroying him, you know, because he has no mental control over it. But it's much more than that, you know. One other piece, I don't want to miss this. I'm so blithering and sleep-deprived on this trip. But there's a piece here I didn't want to miss. Don really got a kick out of this. And since we're in New York, I think it's appropriate. If you've got a fourth edition, if you want to follow along with me, XIV, which I'm too tired to even figure out what that Roman numeral means. I think it's 14. There's a little piece here. You know, I was telling you last night, when I came to this work, because I almost missed the whole recovery process, so when I came to this work, I didn't want to miss anything. I became anal retentive, and I dotted every I and crossed every T, and I wanted to follow every direction precisely as it was stated in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think Juanita was there when this happened. My home group, we registered in New York at GSO. I registered us. I was the first GSR up on South Broadway up there where the, you know, some of you have been to the General Service Office. It used to be on Park Avenue. Now it's up there on Reinhold Niebuhr Place or whatever it is. And because we were in New York, we went up there, and I registered my group there. But then I did another piece that I'd wanted to do for a while. I said, if you read the bottom of this, page 14 in Roman numerals, says, we shall be interested to hear from those who are getting results from this book, particularly from those who have commenced work with other alcoholics. Okay? We should like to be helpful in such cases. So I'm up at GSO, and I've registered the home group, and I said, oh, by the way, to the lady that was the office manager, I said, I'm here to report in from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And she said, what do you mean, report in? I said, well, I'm here to report about the results that I'm getting. She said, what in the world are you talking about? And I whipped out the book, and I said, well, it says right here that you're interested in hearing from people who are getting results using this, but particularly working with others. And we've started to work with people who could never stay sober using the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, taking them through the book and working the steps as they're outlined there, and these people getting sober who never could. So I'm here to report that. She said, duly noted. Okay.
So the doctor's opinion speaks about the mind, the obsession, and it's the same thing for the family member as it is for the alcoholic. I can't stop thinking about what he's doing, what he's going to do, what he has done, how much will he drink, how can I get him to not drink, you know, where can I hide the bottle, how can I threaten him, how can I reward him. I mean, how and how and how. And I said it this way, maybe said a different way, maybe a little more emphasis on a different word rather than that word, maybe the right place, you know. He's all I think about. He's all I think about. He is the main occupation of this mind, just the way booze was the main occupation of his mind. And my body's affected. And like I said last night, I have the allergy of the body, an allergy being an abnormal physical reaction. I had that when he drank. I had that when he drank. And then the doctor says that this is all well and good. However, a psychic change is needed for the person suffering from alcoholism. Psychic change. And he also says that the person suffering from alcoholism has to recreate their lives. He talks about how those of us affected by alcoholism can't tell the difference between what's true and what's false. There's a total lack of perception in my thinking. I don't know what's real. I don't know. I have no clue what reality is. And I'll give you a little for instance. One day, I was going to wash Tom's Levi jacket. I was emptying out the pockets. I pulled out handfuls of Kleenex, pens, construction pencils, papers, and all of a sudden, out comes a needle and spoon. And I sat down on the bed, and I held it in my hands, and just then he came into the room, and he said, Juana, "What's up?" as he saw what I was holding in my hand. And I said, "What is this? What's going on?" And he patted me on the shoulder and he says, "It's not what you think." Whoa, thank God it's not what I think. You know what I mean? Because what I was thinking was not good. So I said, "Okay." I handed it all back to him, got up from the bed with a Levi jacket, and went and put it in the wash. Couldn't tell true from false. And if I even caught a glimmer of what the truth was, whew, okay. There's a joke, then the punchline is, "You're going to believe me or your lying eyes?" I'll believe you, honey. You know, can't tell true from false. My sponsor always says, people ask me, "What step are you on?" And what I ask them is, "In what area of my life?" Because these steps can be worked in many areas of our lives. First time I worked the step was about alcohol in him. And was I alcoholic, which I found out I wasn't. Then it was about his recovery. You see, because I started working the steps when I was 2 years in. He still hadn't worked the steps. I would tell him about working the steps out of the big book, and he just thought I was crazy. He'd be all, yeah, whatever, you don't know, you're not an alcoholic. So I had to let that go, and I had to work the steps around his recovery. I've worked the steps around many, many things. Jealousy, fear, my dad's illness. I mean, I've so many things. So in what area of my life? Every time I get to the place where I find myself restless, irritable, discontented, which is what the doctor's opinion speaks about, I have to ask myself, what's going on in my life? What is it that I'm trying to have power over that has got a hold of me? What is it that I'm trying to have power over that's got a hold of my ass that I feel the flames of hell licking at it, you know? I mean, really, that's what it feels like. It feels like hell is right here and the doors are just about ready to shut in on me. So where am I? Where am I? Because that becomes a normal way of life for me. And the book, in the doctor's opinion, says this then becomes the normal alcoholic life. Paraphrasing. That, I think, is the essence of the doctor's opinion. The allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, and that we have to recreate our lives and we need a psychic experience in order to have that. A complete psychic change is what the book calls it.
You know, I meant to mention this last night, and I might have said something like this. You know, the line that Juanita was quoting is, "To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one." And what's abnormal can become normal. I mean, it just seems like it's, you know, I thought everyone was drinking like I was at one point. And as bad as I thought I was and realized that I was 20 years ago, consistently over the years, and I think this has to do with working the steps with other people, you know, we call it taking somebody through the book or taking them through the work or taking them through the process, whatever you want to call it, I get glimpses of myself. Sometimes I get better glimpses of myself than I do when I'm actually working the steps for me because I'm less defended. Do you get that one? That's a trick, too, that you can use with alcoholics, you know. You want to tell her something, say it to her. She'll be listening, and she won't be defended against it, okay? So if I'm working with the steps with someone, it's not about me, right? It's about them. So my defenses are down, and I absorb things. And what I've found over the years is I was a lot worse than I thought I was. You know, the depth of it has become richer, and if you will, you know, over 20 years. And I'm still finding out stuff, and I'm talking about my active drinking alcoholism. That's what I'm talking about, things I had no idea about. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I think we've hammered that sufficiently. I said it last night that I assumed, and I don't know that anyone ever told me this, but it's certainly what I put together, was that if I would stop drinking, see, I got to the point where I was physically dependent on alcohol, which has nothing to do really with alcoholism. It has a lot to do with drinking a lot of booze. But you don't have to become physically dependent to be alcoholic, as most of you well know. And some people who are physically dependent okay, given a sufficient reason, frothy emotional appeal, can stop or they can moderate. That's the hard drinker, okay? That was not me. But I became physically dependent, and I drank so much that everyone saw it as a problem, including myself. And I assumed that if I will stop drinking whiskey for breakfast, that my life will come together. I'll have some kind of a decent life, or at least a much better life than I had when all I did was drink and think about drinking. I'd become unemployable. I'd become just a complete mess. So I stopped drinking, and I didn't have hangovers anymore. I wasn't physically sick. I wasn't vomiting blood in the mornings. I wasn't doing the things, you know, the family didn't see me stumbling around. I wasn't beating holes in the walls and doing the crazy stuff that I did when I was drinking. But inside, I was a mess, okay? Juanita said it, restless, irritable, discontent, okay? I've got an illness, a disease, a malady inside myself that I found out later was a soul sickness, and now you've taken my medicine away. It's not good. That's not a good deal, okay? So I got real, real busy for 6 years. I did a lot of stuff, okay? There were a lot of workshops in Santa Fe. A lot of famous anonymouses were coming through doing workshops, charging money for it. There was every kind of psychotherapy and psychobabble and, you know, you name it. And I tried everything I could try other than working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and doing things like writing inventory and making amends, right? So I didn't get well, and I didn't get happy. I mean, there were some sweet periods just from physical sobriety. You know, I don't deny that. There were some good things. I went from an alcoholic junkie who, you know, couldn't walk a full circle around we call it the plaza in Santa Fe, it's the square, to 2 years later I was playing ice hockey, you know, and I was, you know, physically I was starting to come back really well. But inside I still had this thing going on. And it came to a head when I was 5.5 years sober, our youngest daughter tried to commit suicide. And it kind of, the whole house of cards that we had going kind of fell apart at that point. It was, you couldn't deny what was happening. And I hit a bottom in sobriety that was at least as bad as the drunken bottom that I hit. And at that point I became teachable. And, you know, it's kind of this chicken or the egg thing sometimes with alcoholism, but I had I was wired a certain way many, many years before I started drinking. It's like this, I've heard people say, I needed to drink long before I took the first one. And with me, I think of two things in particular. I was a little boy. I was 6, 7 years old. I was down in southwestern Kentucky with my grandmother one summer, and I was bitching and moaning and complaining. And my grandmother said, she said, Tommy, do you know what's wrong with you? And I didn't. I wanted to know, you know. Do you know why you're so miserable, she said. And I didn't. And she said, you never think of anybody but yourself. Okay. So she nailed me at 6 or 7 years old. I mean, really, that's what it's going to grind down to. A month ago, I was back in Port Washington. I went to my 40th high school reunion. And I saw people I hadn't seen in 45, 50 years. And I saw one guy, Billy Guerrieri, a guy that he grew up, he's not an alcoholic. He's a kid that grew up in my immediate neighborhood. And I saw him, and we were saying hi to each other after almost 50 years. And I said, Billy, I remember, you know, we were about 11 years old, and I said, hey, Billy, let's you and me blow up the sewer. And he looked at me and said, why would we want to do that? And I said, I knew right then we weren't on the same track, you know. You went home, and I dumped gas down the sewer and blew it up, you know. It's that kind of stuff, you know, budding alcoholic. So I don't know. Where did that come from? I guess I assumed that I had grown up and just wasn't aware of it because I was drinking so much. But in point of fact, I hadn't grown up, and I had a lot of problems. I had a lot of things eating at me. And on top of all of that, I had all of the stuff that I'd done as a drunk, 16 years of drinking, added to all of that other stuff that I came into it with. So I was carrying a lot of junk with me. Tom I, some of you know, we were talking about Tom I this morning, And I heard him talk about the amends process one time, and he said, I've never heard it put better. He said, when I was out there ripping and running and doing the stuff that I did, he said, I was selling little pieces of my soul every time I would do that. And he said, through making amends and working this process and living a decent life, I've been buying back pieces of my soul little by little. And so I hadn't done any of that. You get it? I've been physically dry, but I had not done any of that recovery. And so I was in bad shape, and I hit this wall at 6 years. And they say when the student is ready, then the teacher will appear. And I think that's the case. I've never known God to let anybody down who kept seeking. That's just been my experience, and especially my own experience. And so what I found out was, and I said it last night, alcoholism doesn't live in a bottle of Jack Daniels like I thought it did. It's inside of me, and it always was. And the booze is just medicine for that. There are other things that are wrong. And what I got at 6 years was I can't live a successful life drunk or sober. Okay? When I'm running it, when I'm doing it, when I'm making the decisions, when I'm using this which is broken to try to fix this which is broken, it's not successful. It doesn't work. You know? Our state penitentiary is in Santa Fe, and I go out there Thursday afternoons. We do an ongoing big book study with these guys. And I always tell them, and they love hearing this, I say, you know, in AA we don't talk about right or wrong, good or bad. Said that the catchword we have in AA is, how's it working for you? Does that work or doesn't it work, right? The big book constantly talks about effectiveness as one of the key words, you know. And it wasn't working for me. You know, it just wasn't working for me. I wasn't able to put together a successful life. So what we were taken to, you want to do 52 or you want me to?
Just,
you got something else, huh? She's got something else up her sleeve. Anyway, and I'll let her do that. Page 52, yeah. We were led to page 52. And generally, when we work with people, we'll go all the way through, up to page 43, which I should have read. Wasn't so tired, I would have read.
One of the questions that we're asked to consider in this book is, there's so much here, and obviously all we can do is just give you a little taste. But one of the things I realized, and it speaks to this in There Is a Solution, is that it says on page 19 that we feel elimination of our drinking, elimination for me of my controlling, is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. You know, I could go to meetings for a long time, sit in meetings, sound great, look great, but watch me after I leave you. Watch me when I get in my car. Watch me when I walk into the doors of my work. Watch me when I walk into the doors of my home. And I think this speaks to it. You see, I could pull this off for an hour. I could pull it off for a little while before the meetings talking with you or after the meetings talking with you. But what I was living was an entirely different story. I was told, if you're not taking this program home with you, you don't have a program. And for a long time I thought, yeah, whatever. You know, because I wasn't living it, so I didn't want to listen to that. But the truth was, that's where the real demonstration of this program comes to be. How was I behaving when I walked in the doors? How was I treating my children? How was I treating him? And I will tell you, for a long, long time, I didn't have a program at home. Did not have a program at home. So There Is a Solution tells us there is a solution. Can you imagine that? It tells us a little bit about a fourth dimension of existence. The fourth dimension of existence is the spiritual life for me. And this book later on says it's not a theory. We have to live it. I have to live it in my home. I have to live it in every phase of my life. So it goes on to say at the end of There Is a Solution that there are clear-cut directions given in this book on page 29 showing how we recovered. So that's what this is about. And then it says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. That's what this is about. This is about my relationship with God. See, for a long time, I thought it was the steps that kept me in recovery. It was the meetings that kept me in recovery. It was my sponsor that kept me in recovery and kept me sane. It was my relationship with God. Later on in this book, much, much later, it says in the chapter to the wives, I think, or the family afterward, I can't remember which one it is, it says God's either relieved his alcoholism or he hasn't. It's not the steps. It's not the book. It's not a sponsor. It's not meetings. God's either relieved it or he hasn't. So what does that mean about the book? What does that mean about the steps? It means that's what I do as a practice so I can get out of myself, out of my head, begin doing things for me in a clear, practical manner so that by the time I get to step 12, I have a spiritual awakening. I have a relationship with my Creator that'll relieve my alcoholism. So then in the chapter more about alcoholism, and I got to share this with you because for me this was so classic. It says on page 30 more about alcoholism. And this is the way I read it. Most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real obsessive controlling family members. No person likes to think that he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our thinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove I could think like other people. That I could think like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my alcoholic is the great obsession of every abnormal thinker. That was it. What I found out was that if I'm controlling him, I'm not enjoying him. And if I'm enjoying him, I got no reason to control him. Why would I if I'm enjoying him? The great obsession, the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. Many, many years ago, a woman I worked with walked into the rooms of Al-Anon, and I said, Carolyn, I'm so glad to see you. How you doing? And she says, well, I'm doing okay. And, you know, she came around for about 6 months. And then all of a sudden, one day, I didn't see her. And I didn't see her at work either. And about 3 months later, after that, three-month period, I saw her at the office. And I said, where have you been? I haven't seen you at meetings. I haven't seen you at work. And she said, well, you know, she says, I had a little problem with my heart. And but I'm back now. I'm okay. You know, it wasn't. It was just, you know, a little mini stroke. But you know, I had to pay attention to it. I said, great. And it was. Turns out it was Wednesday. And I said, well, will I see you at the meeting today? And she said, well, you know, I don't think I really need it anymore. And I thought, okay. Well, at that time, it was only her husband who drank, and later on, it became her son, and later on, her daughter married an alcoholic. And I was just reading the paper about a month and a half ago, and I saw that Caroline had passed away, and I never saw her in the rooms of Al-Anon. A friend of mine, Arbutus, from down in Texas, says there's nothing more stressful than living with an alcoholic, drunk or sober. Drunk or sober. And Caroline never felt she needed this program. And it doesn't matter whether she did or not. But I have to pay attention to this because the illusion that someday, somehow, which is my great obsession, that I will control and enjoy him, control and enjoy my children, right? Because at times they're drinking and their use of drugs affects me. That's my great obsession. That's my great obsession. And my obsession can go from one person to another, wherever there's booze. Then it tells me, I had to fully concede to my innermost self Those of you who are alcoholic have to concede to your innermost self that you're alcoholic. I had to concede to my innermost self that I was a controlling, obsessive family member. Then it says the delusion. This is the first step in recovery. This is the first step in recovery. And the delusion that I'm like other people.
God bless
you. Okay. I used to think I was like other people, but what about now? 20 years. 20 years in the program. I'm not the way I used to be. I'll tell you, I'm a far cry from the woman I walked in as. It's like night and day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She hadn't tried to drown me in the bathtub in well over 20 years.
I'm not the same woman. However, it says, or presently may be. That has to be smashed. You see, I'm not the same woman. Later on, when we get to the 10th step, it says, it cautions me about resting on my laurels. I used to think that laurels was, you know, sitting on my rear end. I found out that resting on my laurels is resting on my successes. And I'll tell you, I've had a lot of successes in my life after 20 years. I'd like to take it easy. I'd like to just coast for a little bit. Thank you very much. I'm tired, you know? I got a lot of sponsees. I do a lot of traveling. I got 7 grandkids. That's a lot of work. I'm married, for crying out loud, you know? I've got a lot of successes. So I think I'm probably like other people. Now, after 20 years, it says, Can't think like that. That idea has to be smashed. And if it's smashed, if you took a glass and you smashed it, that means it's no longer usable. That idea is no longer useful for me when I walk in or after 20 years. It says, we know that no real alcoholic, no real obsessive controlling family member ever recovers control. Then it tells me, on page 32, though there is no way of proving it, we believe that early in our thinking careers, most of us could have stopped this obsessive thinking. But the difficulty is that few obsessive controlling family members have enough desire to stop while there is yet time. How about the alcoholic? Did ever come that point where you could stop and then cross the line? Must have been about 10 years ago, I guess. We took a little trip down to New Orleans, and I had just spoken in Beaumont, Texas with my friend Don, and we took a few days and traveled to New Orleans, and, you know, I'd never been to New Orleans. I'm not an alcoholic. I wanted to have one of those hurricanes and, you know, a couple of other drinks and have a good time in the city.
Sex on the beach.
We didn't have sex on the beach.
No.
I had the drink sex on the beach.
There you go.
Okay. TMI. So we go down there, and I end up pretty loaded. And we came back home, and Don was over at our house. He was in Santa Fe doing a workshop for us, kind of like we're doing here. And, you know, we told him this little story, and all of a sudden Don looks over at me, and he said, I know just enough of your story that I do believe if I were you, I would never drink again. And I thought about that for a while. I thought about it for quite a while. I didn't want to do anything too hasty, mind you. So I thought about it, and after a few months, I thought, you know what? I've heard enough stories in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous about people who could drink with impunity, and then one day something happened to them, and they crossed the line. And I thought, I think I'm going to take Don's suggestion. And while I have the ability to make the decision and have choice, I'll choose not to drink. And I made that decision and never gave it a second thought. you know, we'll travel someplace and, you know, Tom will say, why don't you have a drink? And I said, no, I made the decision. And he'll just kind of shake his head and go, how can you do that? You know, how can you do that? I have a healthy respect and a healthy fear. I know my background and I've heard your stories. I've had enough trouble just doing my program to have to do, you know, what? No, thank you. But see, there was yet time for me. There was yet time for me. While there was not time for me was with the family stuff, the obsession about his drinking, the need to control him. So that's the first time it mentions stopping. Then it says on the very next page, where it says, the middle of the page, where it says, young people may be encouraged by this man's experience to think that they can stop as he did on their own willpower. We doubt if many of them can do it, because none will really want to stop. So my question is, do I really want to stop? I get people who come into the rooms of Al-Anon, and I ask them, do you want to stop? The sentence before this says there must be no lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. So one of the questions I ask them is there anything that you think that you haven't done that might work to get your husband, your child, your parent, your friend, your employer, whoever it is, sober? Sometimes they'll say, you know, I've done it all. I've done it all. There's nothing left. But every once in a while, someone will say to me, well, you know, there are a couple of things I haven't done. And it's, you know, X and X. And I tell them, maybe you need to go give it a try. Do you think that if you did that, something might change for them? Well, I think it might. Go do it. Because as long as they have any lurking notion that there might be something that they could do, they're not fully going to give themselves to this program. I came to Al-Anon meetings for 2 years. He wasn't drinking. I always said to myself, if he just quit drinking, I'd be okay. Now he's not drinking. You know what? I'm not okay. In fact, I feel worse after 2 years sitting in Al-Anon meetings and him not drinking than I ever did while he was drinking. So I finally got a sponsor. Finally reached my bottom. There was finally no lurking notion that it was his problem only. And it was only until that point, 2 years later, that I wanted to stop. You see, before then, all I wanted to stop was a little bit of the pain that I had. All I wanted to do, really, was to become a little bit more efficient in my ability to control and manipulate and get away with it so that nobody would know what I was doing. I wanted to get more subtle with it. I didn't want to stop. I wanted to get more subtle. So do I really want to stop? Then on page 34 it says in the middle of the page, for those who are unable to drink, to think moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. And I love the next line. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Not everybody who comes into our meetings wants to stop. Some just want to get the heat off. Like when I sent Tom, first time around, he didn't want to stop. He wanted to stop me nagging at him. He didn't want to stop drinking. My question as a family member is, do I really want to stop the insanity going on in my life, in my life? What's going on in my life today that is making me crazy, that is making me insane? And do I want to stop that? Do I really want to stop that? It goes on to say later on that this is, that it's impossible. We don't have the ability. We don't have the power. The needed power is not there.
So, I'm stark raving sober. I'm 6 years sober. My life isn't working. I'm depressed again. And really, I was on my way out and had become teachable. And somebody said, have you looked at the bedevilments, excuse me, on page 52? And I said, no, I haven't looked at any of this, you know. Hello. I hadn't looked at any of this in terms of step work. I thought the big book was just an inspirational book that you opened up and read some page at random and started a meeting with whatever you had read. But in terms of an actual workbook or a textbook, I had never used it that way. And they said, well, look at the middle of page 52 and check it out and ask yourself, how well are you doing? Ken Devaney says, how's that working for you, Sparky? We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. Are you, Tom? Oh, yeah. Big time. Couldn't control our emotional natures. Well, only when I'm driving, you know. You know, somebody cuts you off and you show them what step you're working, you know. We were a prey to misery and depression. Juanita loves to do this. You know, we live out in the desert and the high desert, but we live in the desert, and you'll see hawks and eagles out there, and they're circling, and what they see is a little mouse or some kind of a rodent. And misery and depression are the hawk. I'm the mouse, you know. And so I'm the prey, and misery and depression are after me. And I was always either miserable or depressed. Not always, but a lot of the time, more often than not. Couldn't make a living. You know, the interesting thing for me is how the big book works on so many levels. You know, if this was boring stuff, I wouldn't be doing it. But every time I come back to it, I have a new experience, my latest experiences to bring to this work. And so what this means to, you know, if I'm sitting down with a guy who's been drinking last week or 2 months ago, and we're going through this, and I say, you having trouble making a living? Well, that means one thing to him. That means, yeah, I've been unemployable for the last 6 years. You know, I'm having a lot of trouble. You know, I don't have any money, you know, and I owe a bunch, and yeah, I can't make a living. That means one thing to him. But if you ask me at 20 years, are you having trouble making a living? That means something completely different to me. It means, is what I'm doing to get the shekels, is that fulfilling to me? Is that my heart's desire? Do I feel like I'm doing the best for God and his kids that I could be doing through what I do? Is it a living and not just survival? You understand what I'm saying? There's a lot of ways to look at that. Go ahead.
How am I doing with my checkbook? Am I balancing it? Am I paying my bills? How am I doing with spending? How's my credit? I remember one time I went into Dillard's and I had an armful of clothes and stuff that I was going to buy, and I made a big mistake one more time. I said a prayer and I said, gee, God, do you think I need all this stuff? Joking. God didn't care. It was a prayer as far as God was concerned, and what I got was, nah, you don't need any of it. I think I kept one thing. I put it all back and I kept one thing. You know, but shopping, spending was taking care of me. It was something from outside making me feel okay. I'll give you a quick for instance. I went to Las Vegas, Nevada many, many years ago before I came in the program. And there's a game called Whack-A-Mole, W-H-A-C-K, Whack-A-Mole, M-O-L-E. And there's this table about this size, and there's about 10 holes. And out of any one of these 10 holes in random order comes this little metal mole. And there's this big rubber mallet. And the object of the game is that when the little mole comes up, you have to whack it before it goes back down in the hole. Well, being the hypervigilant person I always was, because I was hypervigilant watching him, I was good at it. The prizes were stuffed animals, little stuffed animals. I came home with a suitcase full of stuffed animals. But that's what alcoholism is to me. It's like, here comes the first little mole. That's the booze. Down goes the rubber mallet. You get it. All of a sudden, here comes a little mole from someplace else. That's sex. bam, you whack that little mole and down it goes. Up comes another one. Exercise, bam, down it goes. Here comes another little mole. Ah, there's food, bam, here comes another one. Working, working too much. Bam, here comes another one. Shopping, bam. There's always a little mole coming up, you know, and that's why I love the chapter title, More About Alcoholism, because there's always more. There's always something else I need to look at to put through the first step, something that's got a hold of me.
Okay. Am I being, I told you last night we were bankrupt, but we were too ignorant to apply for it, to claim it. We had nothing. We had less than nothing when we got sober. And today we're solvent. We have all the money that we need. We really do. Don said, I was telling someone last night, Mike, said Don used to say, there's never enough money, but there's always enough money. Yeah, chew on that one for the afternoon or something. But anyway, we have enough money. That's what I'm trying to say. But am I a good steward of what God has presented me with? Am I taking care of it well, you know, or do I squander it? When Juanita told me that, she said, I now say a prayer when I go into a store, God, don't let me buy anything that I don't need. I said, hell, I'd never buy a thing if I said that prayer every time I went into a store. That wouldn't be any fun. Okay. We had a feeling of uselessness. You know, I think I told you last night that when I got sober, if I had died the day before, everybody I knew would have been better off because my life had no use whatsoever. It had no purpose. And sometimes I can still feel that. I don't believe that, but I can start to feel that way. We were full of fear. Remember how it's going to tell us later we were driven by 100 forms of fear, more like 1,000. But am I full of fear? Well, I was at 6 years. I was completely full of fear. You know, I'll tell a quick story. When I was drinking, my typical drinking evening would go, come home. I'd been drinking all day. I'd pass out someplace between 7 and 9 o'clock. Okay? I didn't fall asleep. I'd pass out. Sleep like the dead for a period of time. And it seemed like invariably at 3 a.m., or very close to it, 2:50, I had a digital clock, and I'd come stark awake. I'd bolt upright in the bed, and I'd look over, 2:58. I knew it would be. 3:01, you know. Who is it? Scott Fitzgerald. He said, in the dark night of the soul, it's always 3 o'clock in the morning. And it's just, if you know what I'm talking about, you know, and if you don't, you don't. But it's just awful. I mean, to me, that's the worst. And I knew I'd be up for the rest of the night. I thought I had a sleep problem. What I found out years later was the booze had run out about that time, and something's calling for sleep. If I'd taken another drink, I could have gone back to sleep, but I didn't know that. So I would lay there, and I would think about all the crappy things I'd done in my life, all the money that I owed, the people I'd ripped off, the women I had mistreated, the lies I'd told my children, just the despicable life I'd been leading up to that point. And I'd play this back to myself for like 2-3 hours until it was time to get up and have a drink and go off to work, that kind of deal. And then wonder why I was depressed all the time, wanted to kill myself, you know. And what it was that stuff was chasing me. You know, it just absolutely was chasing me. And so stopping drinking didn't end that, you know. I had a bunch of garbage. I'd never cleaned it up. And it was following me into my sober life. That's exactly what was happening. And so I was full of fear because I'd done a lot of things that you'd be fearsome if they were following you around, you know. And that was the deal. I kept feeling like the hammer was going to come down. You know, back in the 60s, we all talked about karma, you know, and I still believe that there is such a thing as karma. I don't understand how it works, but I've learned sober that what goes around comes around, you know. The Buddhists say right action brings right result, you know, and the reverse is true. So I was always waiting for that hammer to come down. So I was full of fear, you know, more sober than I'd ever been, further away from my last drink than I'd ever been. We were unhappy. Of course I was. Couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. You know, before I came to this work, to the book, I sponsored innumerable people. I tried to play junior therapist. I didn't tell you last night, but at 2 years sober, through a bizarre series of mishaps, I became a counselor in a treatment center. Never worked a step. I was a high school dropout, but I was a counselor in a treatment center for 2 years. And so the things that I learned, a lot of it was misinformation. I tried to play junior counselor with the guys I sponsored. It wasn't step work. It was something that I was making up. And, of course, I wasn't effective with it. Most of them got drunk, and I had to go back and make amends to a lot of those people later. So I couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. So what it boiled down to was, you know, I thought that I was always told I was an intelligent kid. I had a high IQ. I lowered that IQ, by the way. I found out you can do that, you know, with chemicals. You can effectively lower that IQ. But, you know, I thought I was a capable guy. I was brought up by people who said, you've got a good mind. You can do it. If you apply yourself, you know, in that horrible, the P word we call it, you just don't live up to your potential. You know, oh, my God. So I assumed that if I stopped drinking, I'd live up to my potential and I'd put together a groovy life, okay? And it just didn't happen that way. You know, I was a failure sober, and now I could see it, you know. And so something more than my power had to come into play, and that's where I found myself at 6 years sober.
Continue with the second half.
Or, you know, wherever you want to go.
Whatever. Okay. What I usually like to do with the second half of the first step, the bedevilments, is I like to do what I call mind mapping. And by that, I mean personal relationships goes on the top of my page. Then I list every single personal relationship I have. I have a relationship with myself, relationship with God. I have a relationship with my husband. Okay? So there's three relationships right there. Then my parents, my children, my employer when I was employed, employees, friends, sponsor, sponsees, grandchildren, whatever personal relationships I have. Then I ask myself, what's not working? What's not working with these? Where am I in my life unmanageable? Where is this relationship unmanageable? And then I list it. And it doesn't take long. Everybody, when I give them this assignment, goes, oh, my God, I'm going to be doing this forever. Nah, 15 minutes tops. Doesn't take long. What's not working? How honest am I being? How honest am I being? How honest am I being with myself? In the chapter How It Works, it says, those who cannot recover are those who cannot be entirely honest with themselves. What does that mean? It means that it's much easier for me. It means that it's much easier for me to be honest with you guys than it is to be honest with me and what I'm up to and why I'm doing what I'm doing. That's the hard part. I spent my whole life lying to myself about what I was up to because I didn't really want to acknowledge it. So am I being honest with me? Am I being honest with him? How am I doing with God? Am I spending time with God? What's not working? And what I found was when I did this, the list on him was, there must have been like 35 things. List with myself, about 6 to 10, you know. God, there was about 4 or 5. You know, my parents, it was, you know. But his was the longest by far. And all of a sudden, as I looked at this, I realized that if there was a problem with him in some area, okay, no communication, no trust, fear, jealousy, what have you, then guess what? It wasn't just with him. It was in every other area, in every other relationship I had. Because it can't just stay in one. It's in all of them. It's just, it wasn't of that magnitude as it was with him. So I saw that it was dominating all my relationships, all of this stuff. And then I list, you know, how's my emotional nature and all the stuff that he talked about. That's the second half of the first step. Now, how many of you have heard that saying, insanity is repeating the same things over and over again, expecting different results? Heard that? Turn to page 37 in your big book. I want you to see the definition of insanity that the book gives. This is after the little story about Jim the car salesman, which I love. I love the story of Jim the car salesman. Jim, at one point, owned a car agency. Because of his drinking, he lost the car agency. Jim was now employed by the car agency. Jim shows up to work on Tuesday. What happened to Monday? Okay, he goes back to work on Tuesday. And he has a few words with the boss. He's a little irritated. So remember what I told you about the self-honesty? Jim's having a little bit of problem with self-honesty, okay? Shows up to work on Tuesday. He's a little irritated. If you owned the car business and you lost it and you're now an employee of the business you owned, would you be just a little bit irritated or would you be downright pissed off? I'd be so pissed I couldn't see straight. I'd want to rip somebody's head off. You get an idea of what I'm like without this program, huh? He has a few words with the boss. Now, if he's really pissed off, how do you think the few words with the boss might go? I think it'd be more than just a few words, right? He let the boss know exactly what he was thinking. He says, because he says nothing serious. Then he says he wants to drive out to the country and see one of his prospects for a car. It goes on and on. Bottom line is, you know, his mind tells him that he can take a drink if he only mixes it with milk. And he ends up having quite a few drinks and he goes out. And he goes on to say that at the bottom of page 36, he said, Jim had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if he only mixed it with milk. Then it gives us a definition of insanity. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. And this is what insanity is. Lack of proportion. Lack of the ability to think straight. How can that be called anything else? That's insanity. I lack proportion in my thinking, and I don't have the ability to think straight. I used to think that it was what I did that was insane. That's not insane. The thinking is insane. The thinking insanely leads to the action. So it's the thinking that's insane. The second step says, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. If lack of proportion in my thinking, if the inability to think straight is insanity, then I have to come to believe in a power that can restore me to sanity. Sanity means I'm going to think right and I'm going to have proportion in my thinking.
I think the natives are getting restless, mm-hmm. and so are the non-natives. And why don't we take a break for 10 minutes? You want to do that?
Sure.
Be back here when?
8:30 by, or 10:30 by that clock?
10:30, be back here.